Iowa Public Radio is fundraising right now, and we could really use your support. The pace of news will not let up, and neither will we. Show your support for this service when you donate now at iowapublicradio.org. Thank you.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up later in our hour, findings of a new study from Iowa State University that indicates how cheese, yes, I said cheese, may protect against age-related cognitive problems. Also in a few minutes, Adam Sullivan of the Gazette joins us. He calls out the state for grinchy behavior. And in the second half hour, we'll listen back to a couple of harrowing accounts from the derecho windstorm on August 10th, as we recall that major news event of 2020, as 2020 counts down its final days. Well, the governor just held another COVID press conference. Let's start this hour by finding more about that, what Kim Reynolds had to say. Natalie Krebs is with us, IPR health reporter. Hi, Natalie.
Hi, Ben.
So what did the governor want to emphasize today?
Yeah, so the governor talked about a couple of things today. The main thing was that, you know, the state says that they will remain on schedule for starting to vaccinate nursing home residents and staff members next week. So there were some questions called into that last week when the state had announced that their allocation for vaccines had dropped by about 20%. But they basically, you know, assured us that we will start that next week.
Mm-hmm. Any more details on vaccinations in nursing homes across the state, how that will proceed, expected challenges?
Yeah, so the state is taking part in the chain drugstore partnership program under the federal government. So they're partnering with Walgreens and CVS. And so basically, employees of those two chain drugstores will go out to nursing homes and actually administer the vaccine. You know, I think they're saying a lot of the Moderna vaccines, which don't require the ultra cold storage temperature that the Pfizer vaccines do, are going to be the ones going out to the rural areas, to the nursing homes. And, you know, as we know, the FDA approved the Moderna vaccine on Friday, and then Iowa started receiving shipments of that vaccine yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What can be said? We had the frontline medical personnel receiving their vaccinations starting at the beginning of last week. Now on to nursing homes. What can be said, or what did the governor say about what comes next, the further rollout of the vaccines and the order of people getting them?
Yeah, so the CDC has made recommendations for, you know, phase 1B, which is the next phase. That the vaccine go to people 75 or older, and then frontline essential workers. So this is, you know, first responders, possibly teachers, people in the food and agriculture business. And then the next layer is phase 1C, which would be people ages 65 to 74 years old. And there are people between, I think, 16 to 64 with high-risk medical conditions and other essential workers. So this could be, you know, people in food service, IT communication, in the energy sector, even in the media, according to the CDC's documents. So the state says basically its advisory council is taking this into consideration, and they're looking at perhaps the fact that they might have to kind of sub-categorize some of these groups, so they might have to break it down even further as we go, depending on how many doses of the vaccine we get.
Mm-hmm. Natalie, give us an update on the latest numbers from our states, from our state, and the trends there.
Yeah, so today we saw 1,276 new cases, 64 new deaths, 651 people are hospitalized. So, I mean, overall patterns, you know, we're still seeing the number of new infections trending downward. The 14-day test positivity rate was, 12.6% today, which is, it keeps going down. That's still a pretty high number. Mm-hmm. Our death count overall is still pretty high. You know, we're still looking at fallout from when the cases were super high a couple weeks ago. Hospitalizations were super high. And hospitalizations have been declining overall. The last couple of days, they've ticked upwards a little bit. But, you know, we are seeing numbers go down.
Right. And there is a new way the state is counting the fatalities, correct?
Yes. So we've seen recently, it's been somewhat confusing. We've seen, you know, a couple days go by, no reported deaths, followed by, you know, on Sunday we had 138, today we had 64, Monday we had zero. So basically, the state is using this new methodology where they're using, you know, a coding system under the CDC. So they basically need to get confirmation from the federal government. So they're kind of releasing deaths in batches now. So I would expect in the future to see, you know, these periods where there are no new deaths reported, followed by, you know, a larger number reported as they get that confirmation.
Mm-hmm. So now we have two vaccines, or will soon, the Pfizer vaccine. Is the Moderna vaccine already in the state? Do you know?
Yeah. So, you know, state officials announced this morning that the first shipment of the Moderna vaccine had come in on Monday. So going forward, the state is expecting to get, you know, shipments of the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine, the two that have been approved by the FDA so far.
Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, the Moderna is a little bit easier to distribute, not quite so sensitive to temperature.
Right, yeah. And, you know, it doesn't require that ultra cold storage. I think it's stable in a refrigerator for about 28 days, which is what's been said. So basically, the state said today, you know, that's going to be the vaccine that goes out to nursing homes. That's going to be the vaccine that goes out to the state's rural areas, just because it's easier to transport. And, you know, so some of these harder to reach areas that don't have those ultra cold freezers are going to be the ones that are going to get this new Moderna vaccine. So its approval has really changed a lot of things, and Iowa really kind of moved us forward in the vaccination game.
Okay, Natalie Krebs, IPR health reporter. Just to add, Natalie, of course, we're coming up on several days of holidays, normally a time for big family gatherings. Limit the size of holiday gatherings. Keep your social distance. Even wear a mask when possible indoors. You cannot be too cautious here. Am I right, Natalie Krebs?
Yeah, and again, with those numbers I was talking about before, you know, they are trending downwards, but public health experts are worried. You know, they said this can turn on a dime, and it all depends on our behavior. So people need to stay vigilant. I mean, just because you keep hearing over and over again that numbers are trending downward, it's because of Iowan's behavior. So, you know, again, limiting holiday gatherings, you know, wearing a mask, really practicing that physical distancing, you know, really, you know, not, you know, acting like this is still a huge thing, which it is, and it's still widely spread across the state, to make sure that it doesn't spread further.
Okay. Natalie Krebs, IPR health reporter. Thanks, Natalie.
Thank you, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Mental sharpness. We're always concerned about keeping mentally sharp, keeping mentally agile into our later years. And it turns out the foods we eat may have a direct impact on that sharpness, that cognitive acuity with increasing age. Well, that's a key finding of an Iowa State University research study described in an article published in the November 2020 issue of the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. The study was headed by principal investigator Ariel Ouellette. He's assistant professor in food science and human nutrition at ISU, also with the help of a graduate student in neuroscience, Brandon Kleinedienst. Ariel Ouellette, welcome back to our program.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Okay. This is a first-of-its-kind large-scale analysis that connects what the foods we eat with later in life, how we think. Tell us more about it.
Sure. So this study was rather sizable for its kind. So we followed approximately 2,000 people using a very rich database called the UK Biobank. And we looked at changes in their fluid intelligence over a period of about 6 to 10 years over several visits. And we were really interested in how different whole foods, individual foods, might be related to whether or not people show the same kind of mental sharpness, whether it kind of declines over time or whether it might improve. And so by analogy, we put a whole bunch of these different whole foods together in a gladiatorial arena. And statistically, we told them, fight this out, guys, and we'll see exactly which one of you comes out on top, which one does best. So lo and behold, apparently the winner was cheese. Regardless of what kinds of models we ran, it was always cheese. And a runner-up for that was alcoholic beverages in general, but especially red wine.
Wow. Okay, just the findings, the gladiators, just the gladiators we wanted to win, at least many of us. So cheese does what to mentally protect us as we age with cognition?
Sure. So we usually think of cheese as being this indulgence where it has lots of saturated fat, it's high in calories, and so on. But there are some benefits nutrient-wise to eating cheese, especially if it happens to be from cheese from, say, like grass-fed cows. So cheese has this wonderful compound, linoleic acid, and we get it from several foods, but cheese is particularly rich in it. And linoleic acid is able to facilitate weight loss. It can decrease inflammation, which has some implications for cardiovascular disease. And the most interesting thing for me is that it can help to dilate your blood vessels. And so it makes it easier to pump blood out throughout your body so that it is easier to absorb more nutrients. And in this case, for part of the frontal lobe that most actively deals with this kind of mental acuity, it can suck up those nutrients more so. And perhaps it might help to explain why we see this relationship with cheese.
Mm-hmm. But you say not all cheeses are created equal as far as this effect.
This is true, and we do wish that we had gotten information about not only does a person consume cheese daily, weekly, but what kind of cheeses. And so I can't tell you from the data if it's, say, a sharp cheddar versus a Gruyere or other things, but I do know that cheeses that have been aged for a longer period of time, also possibly soft cheeses, that those might be rich in linoleic acid and some other nutrient compounds. They also provide some interesting probiotics as well, the cheeses that have been aged more. So that's just a stab in the dark, but it's my best bet.
Mm-hmm. Okay, talk about the alcohol side of this, the runner-up, because, you know, of course, people wish this were true. There's been so much research on this that's reached at least into the popular press in recent years. Maybe you can straighten us out. In what quantity is red wine healthy for our brains?
From what we saw, it was a case set for people who drank red wine on a daily basis, that they're the ones who happened to show this effect the most. It was the most pronounced. And it didn't matter what particular wine variety it was, just merely that you had a glass of red wine. And this is useful because rather than saying, you know, you should just have a bottle a night, which doesn't really work for anybody, that I think this advice goes along with what has been shown in clinical trials for the Mediterranean diet and various other kinds of diets, which is if you have, say, like, a glass of red wine with dinner, that could well be sufficient. Mm-hmm. And I should point out that we controlled for, among other things, people's socioeconomic status, how much education they have. And so this isn't just, say, like, you know, the upper crust indulging in red wine and cheese. And the reason is that all this exists is because, well, only these people drink or eat that. But it seems to occur regardless of, you know, how well off one is or how much education one has.
Okay, I'm seeing another finding here. Quickly address this. Salt is bad. That's a confirmation of something we've known for a long time, but in this case, bad for those who are already at risk for Alzheimer's disease.
Yes. So one of our main emphases in this paper was to see if different dietary components were related to cognition in a different way for people either who had a genetic risk for Alzheimer's or for people who didn't. And when it comes to added salt, it was the case that there was this very strong relationship where the more salt that you added to your food, as well as to some extent the amount of salt in various foods that you ate, were related to less of this mental acuity over time. Obviously, correlation does not equal causation, but we already know that having very salty foods or adding salt in general is bad. Doctors have been saying that to reduce cardiovascular disease for years. But I think our takeaway here is if you know you have a genetic risk, like say your mom or your dad developed it, or you've had a genetic panel and they say you have more risk, it may be that much more worthwhile to stay away from the salt.
Okay, so much in this study. Very interesting. To wrap up our little conversation here, Ariel, the takeaways here are, Have some cheese for your holiday, and don't worry about it. In fact, it may be good for your brain in the long term. Have that, perhaps that glass of wine if you drink alcohol, if you like wine. Any other takeaways?
I would say in general, don't overly salt your food, and very lean meats can be good.
Okay. I have to ask on the way out, Ariel, you want to name your favorite wine, favorite type of wine, favorite cheese combination?
I have to say it would probably be like a Syrah or something spicy with like some Gruyere. Yeah.
That sounds good. I'm going to go with a California Cabernet and a Spanish Manchego. Have you had that cheese?
I have not. What is that like?
It's aged cheese, very strong. Sorry, it's a little salty. Maybe that undoes the good part of it. But in small quantities, it's lovely with a Cabernet.
Ooh, I'll have to check that out.
Well, happy holidays to you, Ariel, and thank you for delivering some of the findings of this study that you were the principal investigator of. If you want to read more, look in the November 2020 issue of the journal Alzheimer's, Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. Ariel Ouellette of Iowa State University, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, the headline reads, Iowa, the state that stole Christmas through civil asset forfeiture. The author is Gazette columnist Adam Sullivan, who joins me now. Hi, Adam.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on. I wanted to talk a few minutes up until the break about your column that caught my eye today. Iowa is on the naughty list, you write, this year for some grinchy behavior. This has to do with a controversial law enforcement scheme called civil asset forfeiture. What is it?
Basically, civil asset forfeiture allows law enforcement authorities to confiscate property. Oftentimes it's cash, but sometimes it might be a vehicle or something of lesser value if they suspect the property has been involved with a crime. The thing about it is that it doesn't require the authorities to press any charge against the owner or the person who is in possession of the assets. And so there's been several cases where people are never charged with a crime. They're not really even seriously suspected of doing anything wrong. And still that they have a hard time getting their money back or getting their vehicle back because the presumption of innocence doesn't apply. So your property is presumed guilty until you provide that you're innocent.
Mm-hmm. And this earns Iowa a very bad grade in a new analysis, doesn't it?
Yeah, so there's a libertarian group called the Institute for Justice. They've been heavily involved with this and other issues in Iowa and elsewhere. They rank Iowa as a D-, so among the worst states, which is to say that our authorities rely too much on this process and we don't have sufficient safeguards to make sure that due process is served.
Mm-hmm. So this is really interesting. Subjects, you know, are forced to prove their innocence. This is a different standard. Prove your innocence and then get your stuff back, as you write.
Right. And so it's difficult to do. And the other thing is, if you say you had lost $1,000 or something that you got pulled over and they took your money, I presume you would have to spend much more than that to get your money back in legal fees and hiring a lawyer. And in some cases, those costs aren't taken care of, even if you are found to be innocent.
Mm-hmm. And you point out at least one example in your column here in Iowa. Walk us through that quickly.
Yeah, there was a case in 2013 where a restaurant owner had about $30,000 confiscated or seized through her bank accounts. She'd been making staggered payments, which is illegal, but she wasn't charged with doing that. She wasn't even suspected of doing anything. And at the same time, the Obama administration was publishing guidance to say, we're really going to only go after people we think are involved in a serious crime. And so this case, the woman in Northwest Iowa, that really flew against what they were saying at the time. She eventually did get her money back more than a year later, but she had to have help from a nonprofit law firm to do it.
Mm-hmm. So surely this law was not meant to target restaurant owners in Arnold's Park. What is it originally intended to do?
It's really for the drug war. And so it really ramped up. It's something like it has been around before that, but in the 80s, they started leaning on it a lot more. And the other thing that coincided with that is more collaboration between state and federal authorities. So here in Iowa, we have drug task forces where they get federal resources and even some federal personnel at the local departments to fight drug crimes. And the idea was kind of that we're going to make these drug criminals, you know, we're going to use the cash that they earned and put that towards law enforcement activities. But as we always see, when we give the government new authorities to govern the war on drugs, that always ends up being used against regular people.
Mm-hmm. In some cases, we should assume, I guess, that it had been used as intended in other cases in the drug war. What about the Iowa legislature? They weighed in on this.
Yeah, in 2018, they passed a law that put some very limited restrictions on the process. There's definitely a push to do more on law enforcement and criminal justice reform next year. And there are a fair number of what you would call right of center groups who are pushing on this and who Iowa lawmakers have shown an interest in listening to. So I wouldn't be surprised if they try to do more on this. And Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller, who's a Democrat, he's also been interested in this.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We have a couple minutes before the break. Let me ask you, Adam, before we go, as we're on the eve of the new legislative session, what do you have your eyes on when it comes to the Iowa legislature?
Yeah, again, criminal justice reform, I think there'll be a lot of pressure to look at it. We'll see if they can come to an agreement. One thing that they definitely will take a look at and that ties in nicely to this is a possible ban on racial profiling in police work. And part of that would also create new data gathering so we could track better if there's racial disproportionality in our law enforcement encounters. So that's been recommended by a committee that was appointed by the governor. That's really important because if, you know, when we look at disparities in law enforcement, if we have law enforcement officers who are making stops on a racial basis or like we're talking about with civil asset forfeiture with some kind of profit motivated basis, we need to know about that. And so the tracking of it is really the first step to being able to take more action to make sure that we have, you know, some sensible rules for how we're governing police interactions.
Okay, Adam, always nice that you can join us and always wonderful to read your columns in the Gazette. Gazette columnist Adam Sullivan. Look forward to lots of discussions in 2021. Adam, thanks for joining us in this brief time today.
Thanks, Ben. Keep up the good work.
Okay, thank you. When we come back, we'll listen to back to a couple of harrowing accounts from our archive from that derecho wind storm, August 10th, the aftermath of that. We'll hear from a Winterset man who rescued the driver of a semi-truck that was blown over on Interstate 80. Also from a Cedar Rapids man, a young man who emerged from a bathroom to find after the derecho that the building around him had disappeared. That's when we return. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
In a time like none of us have experienced before, there's strength to be found in community institutions like Iowa Public Radio. I'm Executive Director Myrna Johnson, and I'm so proud of the thoughtful, informed coverage IPR brings you on the issues that matter. Listener funding is the power source that makes it all possible. Facts, understanding, insight. That's what you fund when you give to this station. Make your gift now at iowapublicradio.org, and thank you.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This half hour, we're remembering accounts from the most devastating weather event in Iowa in the year 2020, the derecho. On August 10th, with little warning, the intense, long-lived, straight-line windstorm barreled across the Midwest with the ferocity of a hurricane. It traveled some 770 miles in 14 hours. Here in Iowa, the monstrous windstorm cut a wide path of destruction across the entire state. It uprooted trees, flattened crops, damaged homes and businesses. Cars and trucks were flipped. At one point, 400,000 Iowans were without power. We begin with the mayor of Madrid, Tom Brown. I started off our conversation from August of 2020 by asking him to describe the damage inflicted on his town.
Overwhelming is the only word I could use to describe it. It was complete devastation. I've never seen anything like it, certainly for our town. I've seen pictures, of course, of other towns following tornadoes and things like that. However, you know, with most tornadoes, it's more of a swath damage where you've got a good section of a city that is still intact and folks that can help out those damaged areas and locations. And in our case, if you you may have looked at the reflectivity reports, Madrid was dead center with the wind velocities at about a kilometer off the ground at greater than 130 miles an hour, and we were at the central central core of that storm. And as I came into town from Des Moines, because I rode the storm out at one of my rehab centers in the basement in West Des Moines, and then immediately as soon as it looked like I could come, I came at the tail end of the storm, came into town, and it was just a devastation. My first place that I went was to try to get to my parents, who live about 2 miles west of town, a drive that usually takes, you know, a couple of minutes to get to, and it took me 45 minutes just to find a path so I could get through town and out to their house.
When you look at the whole array of challenges, this is like being hit by a hurricane, but without the warning that the fellow Americans get on the coasts for those hurricanes, shelter, food, power, all those things. What have you seen as being the biggest challenges this past week that might surprise people who have not experienced something like this?
Yeah, I think the first it was kind of a series of challenges. We were focused on trying to just get roads opened up. We had so many roads, I couldn't even tell you the number, roads that were blocked by trees, because we lost many very large trees that blocked roadways. And then came the scramble for generators to try and get folks hooked up to generators. And I know I luckily had a friend who was a prepper back in Y2K, and it occurred to me that she might have a generator that I could get, so I drove over an hour to get a generator for our house. But food loss, we had trouble with our grocery store being able to sustain its food, and they brought in, we finally got some refrigerated trucks in, they did, from their corporation. Access to gasoline, basic stuff, bar chain oil, just keeping our chainsaws running to try and get folks open so that emergency vehicles could get through.
That was part of my conversation with Madrid Mayor Tom Brown following the derecho. This hour, we're remembering that August 10th, 2020, massive windstorm and some of the heroic acts that took place. Back in August, I spoke with Robert Tunney of Winterset, Iowa, who found himself on I-80 when the storm hit. Well, many of us will carry memories of Monday's massive windstorm for years to come. Stories of where you were when the storm hit, how you sheltered until it subsided, how many hours or days you were without power, how much food you had to throw away, and how much cleanup you faced. Let's talk to a resident of Winterset, Iowa, who has a story from Monday. Robert Tunney, welcome to our program.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Thank you for being on. This is an amazing story you have here. Monday, I'll just sort of start it off and you take the reins. Monday, you were in your Ford F-150, I understand, returning to Des Moines from Williamsburg. So you're driving west with your son, Gavin, in the cab. Now pick up the story.
You know, earlier that day, we had a drop-off in Williamsburg through my work, and my wife had called me just as the storm was hitting Winterset, and she was pretty frantic about what was happening. So, you know, I had a pretty good idea that we were going to be in for a pretty decent storm, and I really had no idea what we were in for. We could see the storm moving towards us, traveling east as we were coming up, and really just out of nowhere, there was a blast from the wind shear that really kind of shook the truck, and the rain started coming down pretty good.
So your truck, is it headed straight into the winds, as far as you could tell?
Yeah, directly right into the wind. I could feel the wind shear coming underneath the truck, and I could feel that that truck was just getting buffeted everywhere.
What happened then? You came upon what? A flipped semi, a semi on its side on Interstate 80.
Where's my phone at, bro?
Right here.
The visibility went down to about 15, 20 feet. And you can see that in the video that Gavin was shooting. And at the time, we were just coming up onto exit 146. And I had turned to Gavin and I said, you know, maybe we should probably pull off here and seek some shelter. But I just kept getting a prompting that you need to keep going forward. And my wife's always told, she's really good about, you know, follow your prompting. You just never know what's going on. So we were down to probably under 5 miles an hour. And then just out of nowhere, there's a big rig on its side directly in front of us. And at this time, the wind shear and the amount of the volume of rain that was coming down was kind of crescendoing. And we saw that and needed to do something.
Right. So what did you do? I mean, you've got driving rain. As you said, the rain is hurting. It's coming down so hard with that wind. You pull up alongside it. You wanted to be safe, I'm sure, on the interstate.
Definitely. You know, I had my son's safety in mind. We just sort of, you can see in the video where we just sort of passed the truck, and then I backed it into it. So I had the windshield of my truck directly into the path of the storm because it was at a slight angle. I told Gavin, you know, stay here, you know, stay in your seatbelt, because I didn't know if there was a tornado coming or I wasn't sure. I wanted to get to that driver. And then Gavin, bless his heart, he's like, Dad, you need here, take a blanket. So he had given me a blanket, which I was sort of able to get my door open with quite a bit of force because of the wind shear. And then as soon as I stepped outside, It was a shock. I mean, I've never been in wind shear like that before. And then as I spread that blanket out, it really caught me almost like a parachute and really pulled me forward. But I was able to get to the side of the truck and move my way over towards the cab of the big rig.
So you get up to the rig. It's on its side. So you climb up on its side, or how did you access the driver?
The front windshield was completely blown out, and Jamie, his the gentleman's name, he was standing up inside the cab, and the engine compartment, the hood, sort of had lifted up as well, so it created this wedge, so to speak, from the elements, and he was in there holding his arm. You could see him visibly shaking. You know, I was really concerned. There was quite a bit of blood that was on his arm and up on his shoulder. He had a short sleeve shirt on and shorts. And, you know, I just went up to him and just initiated, you know, a conversation to see how he was doing. And interesting, you know, Jamie was like, no, go back in your truck. I'm fine. Here, this gentleman was worried about my safety, you know, and I'm worried about his. And I think we need a little bit more of that, you know, in our world today.
So is someone calling paramedics at this point? I mean, it's a question of whether paramedics can reach you during that storm, isn't it?
It is, you know, and as I was in there sort of assessing Jamie and seeing how he was doing, you know, there was no thought in my mind, I need to get him into my car, you know, because you have to worry about shock, you got to worry about temperature. I was concerned about concussion. I was concerned about the bleeding that was coming from his arm, any internal injuries he may have. And so I told him, I said, no, you're in my truck, and we're going to stay here till we get things situated for you. And, you know, he kept talking about, I can't find my phone, I can't call my wife, you know, and I know he was really concerned about that. You know, when I started pulling him towards my truck, that's when the storm was at its full force. And Jamie was a big guy. He's from Pittsburgh. He's like probably 6'2", 250. And the wind shear at that point actually had put him down almost to his knees. And my son Gavin had to push with his feet to open the passenger door because there was so much wind we couldn't open it. But we finally got Jamie inside, got that door closed. I let the blanket go at this point because it was pulling me away. Got into the truck and then started administering first aid.
And how long after did medical personnel arrive?
It took a good hour and a half. Interestingly, my friend from church, they own Midwest Ambulance, and I didn't connect the dots at the time, but their ambulance company is located in Dallas County, and they drove all the way out to 146 to render aid for us. So the sheriff had shown up probably a good 35 minutes, 40 minutes after I made the initial call. You know, and there were a few bystanders who stopped, and there was one woman who pulled over that was a nurse that came over and was sort of doing some just checking to see how Jamie was doing as well. So there were other Good Samaritans who were also being selfless that day and helping us out.
Yeah. How is Jamie now? Do you know?
Yeah, Jamie's great. So I've been in contact with him, his wife, his brother-in-law. He's a Pittsburgh Steelers fan, and he told me the next day it felt like he just went a couple quarters against the Steelers with no pads on. just some superficial injuries. His wife was really thankful. They were very kind, and I told Jamie, he travels through Iowa quite a bit, and I said, the next time you're in Des Moines, you got to hit me up so we can go out to dinner.
Oh, that sounds like a wonderful plan. Before we go, I have to ask you, Robert, you mentioned early in this conversation, you feel like you need to follow the prompting. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, certainly. I have a great example of my wife who last year ran into a burning building, and she rescued a family of five here in Winterset. And you know, we believe that Heavenly Father, the Lord, gives us promptings in our minds to guide us on where to go and what to do and who to help. And you know, it was interesting, as I was talking to Jamie, I said, so at what point did you feel like you needed to pull off? He said, you know, at that exit, I heard a voice in my head that said, pull off, but I didn't. And he ended up having the accident. And at the same time, I was getting the same impressions to keep going forward. So if we follow those promptings and we follow those impressions, some people call it the still small voice, we can do a lot of good in this world, and we can definitely help lift each other up. And I think that's something all of us should really pay attention to.
Okay, Robert Tunney, what a story. Thank you so much for telling it. And of course, the great deed that you did on Monday there and made an impression on your son. He was part of it too. Robert Tunney, thank you so much. Resident of Winterset, Iowa, with a story that will be passed on for generations, I'm sure. Robert, thanks.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
My conversation with Robert Tunney of Winterset from August of 2020. Our final derecho experience comes from Brendan McCormick, owner of McCormick Painting Services based in Cedar Rapids. We discovered Brendan's story through a video he posted recounting that incredible event.
Frankly, quite terrifying to watch parts of your video, Brendan, as you document how the storm demolished your business, leaving only an inner bathroom where you fortunately took shelter. And we have a little bit of audio from that video, but first of all, just so we get a picture of it, describe the building where you were. These are common structures in industrial parks. What are they?
Right. So where the shop was just a business park full of a bunch of other units, and they're all built of the aluminum sheeting siding, and they're all relatively new. So it was a great place to be at the time, but everyone had their businesses structured out of there. And yeah, it was just like a common structure you'd run a business out of.
Right.
But unfortunately, the storm kind of had their way with those.
Okay, so August 10th, have you walk us through what happened to you that day. You're at work. When did you first realize this was no ordinary storm? Because you turned your video on.
Right. I actually didn't know it was going to be a serious storm until I saw the street signs went over. I had a friend check in from Des Moines saying it was a serious storm, but I thought it was going to be like the usual, like, thunderstorm, a little bit of lightning, nothing too crazy. But I walk in the shop, walk back out, and I saw the trees bending, street signs bent over. So I thought, oh, this is going to get serious, because it just picked up at that point. And that's where I decided to start filming.
Okay. We want to play a little bit of audio. You'll hear just hitting, the things hitting the roof. Perhaps we'll listen to the audio that ends with you
I think talking to yourself, I would do more than you did here, I think, in terms of trying to reassure myself and hope for the best. But then you can describe what moment this is. Let's listen to the audio first, Brendan McCormick. This is you recording on August 10th in your place of business. And I believe you're peering your camera out of the bathroom, the only thing that stood after this storm passed by. Let's listen to the audio, Brendan, then you can tell us about it.
Sounds great.
Oh, man. Oh, man. Oh, no. Oh, no. All right. Please hold.
Please hold. Give us your thoughts at that moment, because what you can see in the video, you're looking out of this bathroom area at the ceiling of this structure above you. It starts to vibrate and move, and then it just disappears, right? And you go back into the bathroom. And what are your thoughts?
My thoughts at that point was, I kind of thought that was going to be it, because I saw the shop itself get torn open like a can opener. So I thought, I guess the bathroom has a better chance of holding. But if that's what happened to the bigger building, I don't know what's going to be the end of this bathroom. But luckily it held and we're here.
Yeah. So when you say that would be the end, you mean that you were done?
Yeah, I kind of thought that was going to be it, because I was holding the door closed because I locked it first, but it got kicked open a couple times just from stuff flying against it. But with the wind speeds, I figured if a dumpster comes flying at the bathroom at 100 miles an hour, me holding the door closed isn't going to do a whole lot.
No, it isn't. And how long were you in that bathroom listening to those ferocious winds?
I think it was between 30 and 45 minutes. Once I closed the door the first time, I didn't look out after that.
Right. It was an incredibly long storm, wasn't it? I mean, where I was, I went out, I thought, oh, can I venture out now? And then it was like, no, you can't, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it was terrible.
Yeah. So I wonder, in this video, were there parts of the original video that you cut out, things that you didn't want to have heard? Because frankly, Brendan, I would be more panic-stricken than I heard you. I would be on the hysterical side. Be honest, were there things cut out here?
Yeah, I definitely cut a little stuff out. There were two points where I got pretty panicky. But yeah, I thought it'd be best to cut those out of the video.
Okay, good. That just reassures me. You're a normal human being, because otherwise you've got superpowers of staying calm in a situation where, frankly, anybody watching this video, you could have died very easily had things gone a little bit different, right?
Right.
Right. We're glad you're with us, Brendan. Talk about the scene. We've got just a minute or two left. The scene that you emerged out, when you emerged from the bathroom, what did you see?
What was left of our shop would stay in the area, so all the walls just caved in, or even the garage door went flying from the front of the shop all the way up to where the bathroom was. And everything was just piled on top of each other, like something just came through and just ransacked the entire place with like a bulldozer, honestly. But yeah, we had paint cans spilled over. The siding was laying all over the place. Shelves were knocked down. The glass from the front door was broken. It was not a pretty sight.
Right. And you and others around immediately start searching, and this is on the video, for people. I would think so too. People under the debris, right? Under the walls. Fortunately, no injuries, right?
Yeah, everyone in that area made it out okay. And I think there were like between a dozen and 15 people in the area. So it's a miracle we're all okay.
Excellent. Brendan McCormick, we have to go now. We appreciate you recounting that. You can find Brendan's video on YouTube. Brendan McCormick, owner of McCormick Painting Services in Cedar Rapids. I love your logo. I saw it on the truck that seemed to survive fairly well out in the parking lot. We take the pain out of painting.
Yes, sir.
Good luck with your new business. What a baptism by fire. Brendan, thanks for telling us your story.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
Brendan McCormick of McCormick Painting Services of Cedar Rapids. This half hour, we've been remembering the derecho, an event from 2020 that many Iowans will carry for the rest of their lives. I know I will. A tree fell on my house during this broadcast. Maybe you heard it. I was knocked off the air mid-sentence. Iraqi forces were quickly overwhelmed. Coalition forces swept through that country.
And we're having some technical problems reaching Ben. Are you? Do we have you back yet? No, host. We're having a storm moving through here in the Iowa City area, and we'll see if we can connect yet with Ben Kiefer, who's broadcasting from his home. I think our only choice is to go to the BBC. Now our power is out completely here.
River to River is produced by Rick Brewer, Matt Alvarez, and Caitlin Harrop. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.